with a funding gap in meeting the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030, which all of Asia is currently projected to miss, there is a need for us to explore innovative financing solutions that brings together different forms of capital through what is popularly known as blended finance. Welcome back to Impact Investing Musings. I'm Vikas Arora, Chief of Impact Investing at AVPN. And in this episode, we will discuss what blended finance means in today's markets and how it can be implemented at scale to fund the SDG gap. I'm pleased to introduce our guest speaker for this episode, Ms. Nandini Chowdhury, Principal, Head of South Asia and member of the Group Council at Crossboundary Group, and our host, Temur Nabili.
Let's begin with what your definition of blended finance is in the Asian context.
So yeah, before we get into the concept of blended finance, I think we can maybe take a step back and consider the macro view. We are currently looking at the Asia-Pacific region, which is geographically and economically very diverse, with a fair mix of developing economies, developed economies, and economies in transition. The region is quite exposed to climate and macroeconomic risk, considerably so, and quite often the gap between the perceived and the actual risk is very high. On the other hand, if you look at the UN estimates, it says that, you know, for the Asia-Pacific region to realize its sustainable development goals by 2030, there is an annual additional investment of about $1.5 trillion that is required. So here we are dealing with a region of considerable perceived risk that needs this huge inflow of capital in order to realize the sustainable development goals. And we are faced with a classic chicken and egg problem. Does the capital flow in first in order to create this demonstration effect for these markets to reduce the perceived risk? Or do we spend time in intelligently crafting risk mitigation solutions and explore them first in order to crowd in private capital? Well, the answer lies in balancing both, and I think blended finance here comes to the rescue, right? It is probably the best tool that is available to create that balance.
Well, you talk of perceived risk, but you've also said it's an extraordinarily diverse region. The perceptions in each country within that region must be somewhat different.
Yes, exactly. And it is not only about the country perception, right? Even if you look at the sectoral perception across these countries, it is different. Say, for example, if I look at the commercial and industrial solar market or the rooftop market, it is perceived as a very safe market in India. But at the same time, if you look at the neighboring country, Bangladesh, there are barely like 2 years worth of projects that you can, you know, look at to see, you know, how they have performed. So it is a layer of country level risk. It is a layer of sector level risk, and the diversity is across sectors, across countries. So there is like a multiple layer of interaction that is happening in the region.
So you're saying that, therefore, the blended finance model is a model that is appropriate to multiple different circumstances, right? That it can be adjusted according to the circumstances in each different place. But can you give me a sense of what the general definition is? And then we'll go into the details of how it varies in different contexts from there.
Yep. So by definition, blended finance is essentially a structuring method where you're utilizing catalytic capital or development funding from various sources, public or philanthropic sources. And you're using this to increase private sector investment to cater to sustainable development goals. In simple terms, what does it mean? We can take a transaction level view here. Say, for example, there is a transaction where returns are very high, but the risk is higher and doesn't suit the appetite of a typical commercial investor. Take another transaction, say, for example, where the risk is moderate, but returns are also lower, and this is lower than the commercial investor's threshold. In both cases, there is a possibility of hitting this middle ground where we balance the risk and return. You could look at getting a financial instrument like a guarantee in the first case, which can back the transaction and reduce the risk. you could also get a concessional pool of capital that gets allocated a lower return, thereby preserving the higher return expectations of commercial investors in the second case. Both these structures are very interesting approaches, and what it's essentially doing is it's stacking various forms of capital to increase the comfort of a commercial investor to invest in the transaction. So if I take a step back again and look at blended finance, to me, it is essentially a balancing tool where at a transaction level, it is creating a balance between mitigating risk and mobilizing private capital. And at a philosophical level, it is balancing the needs of commercial returns and development outcomes.
Okay, so given the variability, not only in the structure of the blended finance mechanism, but also in the circumstances where it's applied, even though there is this variability, is there a sort of a core model? Is there a core process that is involved? And what are the components?
If you look at the general blended finance terminologies and archetypes, there are certain types of transactions that you can probably classify blended finance into, right? So there are various archetypes that are defined by various blended finance organizations. If I have to classify it, I can classify it into five different subsegments. One is design or preparation funding. Say, for example, there is a project which needs substantive development capital and needs support in, you know, structuring that investment. Then there is technical assistance, where, you know, the funding is essentially going to build the capacity of the businesses, or you know, almost like an ecosystem enabling funding. Then there are result-based financing, where, you know, it is tied to pay outcomes. The ultimate payments or incentives are tied to outcomes, and a donor or a philanthropic organization pays for those outcomes. Then there are the classic models of guarantees and concessional capital. So guarantees, basically protecting investors against capital losses, providing credit enhancement, and then concessional layers where you just have a subordinated or junior layer of capital compared to other commercial investors. So these are the ballpark archetypes that you see in the market. Now, depending on the sector, on the transaction, on the market, a typical blended finance transaction will be a mix of maybe all or some of these archetypes.
Are there some fixed principles that guide your work in blended finance? What imperatives do you keep in mind when you're structuring a transaction?
I think when you're considering a blended finance transaction, you overarchingly have to look at a few concepts. Number one is leverage. So how much of your philanthropic capital or development capital is able to mobilize private capital? So typically we talk about 3x leverage, 7x leverage, 10x leverage. It basically means that if you are pooling in $1 of philanthropic capital, you are able to mobilize 7x times or 10x times of commercial capital. Then impact is a strong focus. It has to be measurable. It has to be additional. And, you know, until and unless you have measurable impact from the transaction, the blended finance intervention can fall through. And obviously returns. Like, ultimately, the goal is to deliver market-based, risk-adjusted returns for the private sectors. And it is achieved through allocation of the risks in part or full to the development finance tranches on the non-commercial terms. And lastly, I think additionality, I have harped on this throughout the conversation, additionality is superbly important. If you are working on a transaction, I can give you an example of where we have seen this fail. So there was a guarantee instrument that was being structured for a financial intermediary. Again, not mentioning the intermediary here, but a donor organization structured a guarantee instrument for the financial intermediary with the agreement that they will be increasing lending to small and medium enterprises in the agriculture sector. After 1.5 years of the program, what was noticed was that obviously there was a demonstrated increase in the lending that was going to the sector. But there was no evidence that this lending increased due to the guarantee product. So So what was happening was that the guarantee layer was there, but the financial intermediary was still lending to the same set of customers, the same profile of customers. So the additionality component was not taken care of at all. So there are examples of such failures as well. And it is a classic example where, you know, during the structuring phase, measurement side of things was not really taken into account, and the donor organization kind of missed that part as to, you know, how do I make sure that the guarantee instrument is actually creating value for the sector.
You spoke about the risk element to that. Is the risk also variable, and are the rewards variable, or are there, again, is there some consistency in who bears the risk and who gets the rewards and how those are apportioned?
So generally, the essence of blended finance is kind of shifting that risk, right? So if there is a commercial investor that you want to get into the transaction, what you're trying to do for that investor is to shift the risk exposure to investors who are more aligned to development outcomes, and they are not looking at returns per se, or maybe they are okay to take a sub-market return. So it is more of a risk shifting exercise from what we have seen. And generally, the risk is most often transferred from commercial investors to philanthropic actors or to donors who have a different mindset while promoting these structures.
What role do each of the partners play? What is the role of each of the partners in the blended finance deal?
If you have to see a typical blended finance deal, there can be different sort of actors, right? Again, we have to think of the archetypes at the same time, but I'm talking about a simple transaction. Say, for example, there is a solar project, which is a large-scale commercial solar project, which has a PPA with the government. In that transaction, there can be various actors. Number one, we want to get commercial investors or lenders in the place. They will have a senior investment profile in the transaction. They are typically investing through equity or loans, and they are expecting commercial returns. But then we were talking about risk. So you have, say, multilateral development organizations or DFIs who come in, who provide maybe a junior layer of investment support, say, for example, in the form of senior, in the form of mezzanine debt, junior equity, and sometimes they also provide guarantees. So they are essentially bearing or taking away, shifting some of the risk from these commercial investors to their profile. Then you have certain, you know, donor organizations who are actually providing transaction advisory support. Say, for example, the USAID and the UKAIDs of the world, who are actually providing capital to bring down some of these transaction costs. Say, for example, the legal costs associated with the transaction, the financial advisory costs associated with the transaction, which can be substantive. So there, depending on the type of transaction, there can be various players who are acting, and they have various roles to play depending on how the blended finance structure transaction is structured.
All right, so that's kind of the theoretical background. Those are the ideas Yep. behind it. Give me some practical examples. Tell me give me a sense of some models that have worked in real life in your experience.
I can give you an example of one of our own investment platforms, CrossBoundaries investment platform known as CrossBoundary Energy. So back in 2013, when we launched this fund, we were actually able to pool in commercial capital by using a junior tier of funding through USAID. The total size of the fund was about 8.8 million, out of which 7.5 million was class A equity, which is the senior tier in the fund, which was owned by private investors. And the class B equity, which is the junior tier, was funded by USAID, and it was about 1.3 million. So what it did was it was able to create this, you know, pioneering demonstration effect for the sector and for a geography which investors are not generally comfortable with. To give a background, CrossBoundary Energy develops commercial industrial solar projects in and around Africa. So as you know, the country risk premium is pretty high. The risk perception is very high for investors. And what this structure was able to demonstrate was, you know, the private investors were able to come in at the fund level and still create the impact that was needed for the sector, for the continent. And this was only possible because of the junior tier of funding that came from USAID.
And tell me about how that created value.
So in terms of creating value, I think what we were able to do is we are now grown into a multi-million dollar fund, and we have been able to close multiple projects, and we are owning and operating assets across Africa, right? So back in 2013, when the market did not have any historical background of commercial industrial project, solar projects, and did not know, you know, how these projects will fare, got the demonstration that, you know, these projects can be commercially viable. And eventually we were able to return the complete junior tranche back to USAID, which showed that, you know, blended finance is essentially a tool to move a sector or to move a project from its early stages of development or early stages of growth to an ultimately commercially viable structure.
Was this particular deal an easy one, and one that operated as planned, or were there challenges? I mean, give me some examples of how there might be challenges and barriers to implementing policies and plans like this.
The challenges are multiple, right? So I can give you example of from the region. Say we were executing a blended finance transaction in Bangladesh. I think the first and foremost challenge is understanding the concept, right? A lot of these developing nations and the actors you're working with do not understand the concept of blended finance. So in this particular case, we were working with a financial institution, and to help them understand the methods of structuring the transaction, monitoring and evaluating the transaction was a pretty uphill battle. The other challenges that we typically face is, you know, tailoring the blended finance to the local context. And this was particularly true in the Bangladesh case, where, you know, we were looking at the typical blended finance archetypes, but when we were looking at applying them to Bangladesh, there were certain, you know, country level idiosyncrasies that we had to keep in mind. And then I think another point to keep in mind is obviously the monitoring and evaluation of the blended finance transaction. So quite often what we have seen is there is not enough attention paid during the structuring stage. And what happens in that case is, you know, outcomes which are not measurable, which are not impactful, and most importantly, they are not additional. The idea of blended finance is to pool in development capital so that, you know, it has this mobilizing effect on commercial capital. It has this additionality for the sector. And if you are not structuring it in the right way, the additionality concept is sometimes lost.
When you use the phrase, if you don't structure it the right way, I mean, obviously the question is, what is the right way? Is there a right way? Give me an example of what's the wrong way. I mean, any failures that demonstrate that principle?
So yeah, I think one example of failure that I have seen is a particular transaction, again, not naming the transaction or the beneficiary, where we saw that a blended finance deal was structured in a way where, you know, 80% of the capital was in the form of grants, 20% was in the form of commercial investment. This is not really a blended finance transaction where you are mobilizing significant commercial capital. You have to leverage more than 3x as a rule of thumb, right? This is essentially a grant transaction. You cannot call it blended finance. And you are not really setting the company or the organization up for success, or, you know, you're not putting them in the path to profitability or path to growing mentality where they will eventually be ready to absorb more commercial capital. The essence of blended finance is to help organizations or sectors or countries to grow, to move from developing early stage cycle to a matured, able to absorb commercial capital stage. And very important to see is, you know, the commercial viability of these transactions. So ultimately, the blended finance transaction should be designed in a way where you are also promoting commercial viability of of the company that you're supporting, say, for example. And that's where, you know, other archetypes of blended finance come to play, you know, technical assistance facilities, where, you know, you are actually putting in money to develop the capability, you know, you're spending considerable amount of capital to for capacity building of the entrepreneurs. That is also superbly important, because unless and until all of this is done together, these transactions will not be successful in the long run.
Yeah, the capacity building aspect of it seems to be key, doesn't it? You mentioned earlier on about idiosyncrasies at country level, largely focusing on the lack of knowledge and expertise as to how these things work. Is there, do you think, a growth in that market where the local people are beginning to get more familiar with this process and more able to deal with the idiosyncrasies?
I think the answer is yes or no. In Asia, if you look at India, it is getting matured slowly and steadily, and blended finance is becoming more mainstream. At the same time, if you look at countries like, say, Sri Lanka, maybe Bangladesh, Nepal, it is still far from maturity, right? India has demonstrated transactions where there has been considerable success stories in the blended finance world. Whereas, you know, there are failure stories as well. The number of success stories is probably higher. People do understand the concept. People do understand the structuring nuances. But if you look at neighboring countries, like I gave the example of Bangladesh, it is still a long way to go. So I think every country in South and Southeast Asia is at a different stage. And it's probably a matter of time where, you know, this becomes more mainstream.
So there is a requirement for blended finance. It's a great solution for certain situations in developing Asia for being able to go through with projects. Tell me about how you marry that opportunity with the understanding of the private sector. Where is the interface between the needs of the country where blended finance is the answer and then the process of generating the interest amongst those players who need to get involved in the deal?
Again, the answer lies in structuring the transaction adequately, right? At the structuring side of things, first of all, it needs to be robust. It needs to be aligned with the development principles. It needs to be aligned with the ultimate goals. And then it also needs significant marketing. So if you are spending considerable time and effort and you pool in the necessary resources and maybe advisors to structure it correctly, they will be able to market it correctly to the necessary players. A lot of this requires considerable, I would say, understanding of the nuances of the transaction. Say, for example, if you go to a traditional commercial investor or a pension fund and say that, hey, will you invest in a solar project in Bangladesh? The answer will be no. But if you are able to numerically and theoretically explain that this is how we have gotten development actors into the transaction and significant names who are sort of anchoring the transaction and, you know, mitigating the risk, that's when the transaction becomes interesting to this commercial player. So a lot of the effort also goes into translating this development, translating this concept in a language that commercial investors will understand. And that language is essentially the language of risk and return. What am I doing at a transaction level to reduce the risk? What am I doing at a transaction level to increase the returns? And that is as simple as that. We just have to simplify it and make sure that the commercial investors are able to understand that concept.
So you speak of a lack of understanding at the country level and the people within these countries where you're trying to implement a blended finance solution. But how great is the understanding from the private sector providers? You know, how much explaining do you have to do to investors to let them know that this solution that you put in place is appropriate to their needs?
That depends on the class of investors you're reaching out to. Right now, blended finance is all mainstream in the Western world. So most of the actors kind of understand the concept. And again, if you are able to sort of translate the opportunity into clear investment terms, it is not an uphill battle. I think what the major challenge that we have seen while executing transactions in the region, especially Asia Pacific, is kind of mobilizing the concept for the regional actors. Say, for example, the regional donors, the family offices, who also play a huge role in the transaction. And they have significant pools of capital that can be mobilized for such interventions in the region. But then I think the majority of the effort sort of goes into making these actors understand how they can shift from their, you know, traditional impact investing or grant making mentality to a more holistic blended finance approach.
Yeah, and that's the thing. How do you tell me how you sell that idea that there is value and opportunity in this model?
I think it all depends on, you know, how do you understand the motivation of these class of investors, right? So right now I'm talking about, say, regional donors and family offices. Most of the family offices these days have this increasing urge to, you know, have a meaningful impact, have a lasting impact of the wealth that they have been able to generate over generations. And this, you know, having a meaningful impact through their wealth is sort of translating into impact investments. Now, for them to understand the concept of blended finance is simple because they already understand impact investing, and all they need to understand is impact investing is just a subset of blended finance. Rather than looking at individual transactions, what you can do is look at a blended finance intervention where you are mobilizing that capital for ultimately the same outcomes, but it has a much larger impact on the sector or the ecosystem. So understanding the motivation of these investors is very important. From the donor community point of view or the philanthropic point of view, and even some of these family offices have certain pool of capital that goes towards grant making, it is important to understand and explain to them that, you know, grants, although they are amazing tools to sort of support early stage growth of sectors and companies, ultimately, what these companies need is series of interventions to reach that commercial viability stage, because otherwise this is not going to be a sustainable sort of impact. So what we typically try to make these donors and family offices understand is, like, if you want to have sustainable impact, which is in fact in your DNA, that is why you are looking to expand to these sort of investment opportunities, this is the way forward, and you can move away from that grant making sort of endeavor to more, you know, holistic blended finance structures where you are creating measurable impact and you are creating additional value in the ecosystem.
Let me finish off with a question about scale. I mean, do you think that the opportunities in the Asian market have enough scale and attraction to attract really big commercial capital? And if not, how can that be expanded?
The scale definitely exists, right? Like I began saying that, you know, the current additional investment need is about $1.5 trillion annually to meet the SDG goals by 2030. So there is definitely scalable opportunities in the market.
But is that opportunity in many, many small buckets, or are there enough big enough projects to attract some big players?
Depends on the sector and the country. So, for example, if you're looking at large-scale infrastructure projects, they are scalable by themselves. If you're looking at sectors like agriculture, maybe healthcare, a lot of times these are not scalable. So here, I think it's important to understand that blended finance as a concept can be utilized at various levels of transaction and various types of transaction. So it can be at an individual transaction level where you are giving that blended finance instrument to an individual company or an individual project. It can be at a fund level where, you know, you are actually pooling in capital at a fund level, which is kind of able to give you the scale. And a lot of times it is also at capital market transactions like bonds, where, you know, guarantees often play a big role. So even if there are sectors or markets where there are not individually scalable opportunities, you can pool these opportunities together and have the ability to scale up investments for the sector and for that market.
You have been listening to Nandini Chowdhury of Crossboundary. In the final episode of this series of Impact Investing Musings,
we'll be looking at the practice of impact investing in frontier markets. Joining us for that conversation will be Bradley Kopsik, the Cambodia Country Director at Incitor Partners. I hope you'll join us for that. Until next time, bye-bye.